You're listening to the Music Marketing Manifesto Podcast, where you'll learn advanced strategies, tactics, and tips for actually selling your music. Yay! If you'd like to learn more music marketing strategies, then go to musicmarketingmanifesto.com. That's musicmarketingmanifesto.com. And sign up for your free copy of the Music Marketing Blueprint. Now here's your host, John Oshaka.
All right, John Oshaka here, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Music Marketing Manifesto Podcast. In this episode, we've got something pretty cool for you. It is an interview with none other than Xerxes Horde of the New Jacobin Club. Now, if you're not familiar with them, the New Jacobin Club, they are doing some pretty out there stuff. You know, bands like Gwar come to mind in terms of the level of theatrical accoutrement. I don't know how you say that. The level of just sort of stage antics and the sort of over the top intense nature of the band. They're doing something really unique, really different, and they connected with me through Music Marketing Manifesto, my course. That's MMM 3.0. They signed up, became members of the course, and one of the members, Xerxes, who you're going to be talking to, he kind of immediately stood out as someone who had a good handle on this stuff. He implemented the strategies, he asked the right questions, and pretty quickly had some real success with it. He was able to I don't know if I should talk to you guys about the numbers or not right out of the gate, or just let the interview speak for itself. I guess I should give you a little teaser. He was able to pull in a conversion rate of, I believe he's going to say, nearly 20%. I can't remember if it's just over or just under 20%. And when I say conversion rate, I'm talking about sales. I'm talking about the number of people that signed up for his mailing list that ultimately purchased his music. And if you're not familiar with direct response marketing and what's normal, that's very good. That is a very high ratio. It may be the highest ratio that I've heard anyone report back yet. He did everything right and had some real success. And I asked him to sit in on an interview to share his story because, I think many people listening might be thinking, you know, my music's too outside of the box. I'm not a mainstream pop artist or singer-songwriter, so I don't know if this stuff is going to work. Well, the opposite is actually proven true in my experience. The more niched out you are, the more genre-specific you are, the better you tend to do, because the easier it is to find and tap into your audience and their interests and their pre-existing passions. And that's what they were able to do. I think you're really going to pick up a lot of insight from this interview that you're about to listen to. Now, a couple of things before we jump in. There are some audio issues. I've been sorting out some audio issues with recording Skype calls, and I think I've got them sorted out. However, this interview was recorded a little while ago. It was actually the inspiration for making sure I got to the bottom of those recording issues. It's more difficult than you can imagine to get some decent sound out of these Skype recording calls, which is how most of these interviews that you listen to and these podcasts are done. Anyway, certainly been difficult with my operating system and sound card, and I think I've got it sorted out, but the audio you're about to hear is less than perfect. So I appreciate you bearing with me on that. Just know that we should have it sorted out for you in time for the next episode. So with all of that said, I think we should just jump in and take a listen to everything that Xerxes has to say. Again, I think he's done a great job, and I think the insight that he brings to the table and his personal experience, not only with my course Music Marketing Manifesto, but the with the whole direct response marketing, aka direct to fan marketing approach that we've been focusing on here in the podcast and over at musicmarketingmanifesto.com. All right, without further ado, I've got Xerxes Horde on the line. Xerxes, how are you doing?
I'm fantastic.
Great. So, right out of the gate, people are hearing this name, Xerxes Horde, and it's probably generating a little curiosity there. Why don't you tell people a little bit about the New Jacobin Club, New Jacobin Club, went and did that again, yourself and your history, and just a little bit about the kind of music that you're making.
Sure. This group has been around for just over 15 years. We are in the we're up in the biggest expanse of Western Canada where there is very little or nothing. So there's we're in a geographically a little isolated. But we've been around for a while. We are a group of musicians. We have we performance artists with us. Among us, there are art teachers and music teachers, and we do a very theatrical show. And in some places, it's a little controversial. It's kind of, I would say, we've had a hard time describing what we do to some people. I've heard some people say it's like the cross between Alice Cooper and Cirque du Soleil or something like that. But we really do exist for the live show. But we do have we're about to release our fifth album this fall. So.
Wow, and it's fairly heavy music, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
It's not as heavy. You know, that's the interesting thing. Is I really don't think it's as heavy as people expect it to be when they hear it. And that I think that's an indication of that is how many different types of people actually are fans of ours and buy our stuff. And some of the people that are into really, really heavy metal stuff really don't like what we do because there's a big kind of theatrical, almost Broadway musical element to some of it. And
right.
Do have some orchestrations. We have an electric cello player. We have I lead vocalist along with Poison Candy. She's the other kind of lead vocalist, and she plays theremin as well. So we have lots of different colorful components of the band that kind of separate us from just straight ahead heavy metal groups and whatnot.
So, gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. And yeah, describe what people see, because I think that's a big part of the group. And, you know, obviously this is an audio format. People are listening to this, but it's such a huge part. Describe what people see when the band takes the stage.
Well, we are right now, we are there are five instrumentalists. There have been as many as seven in the past, and we usually have one or two or three or even four additional kind of background singers and performance artists. And most of our shows revolve around a theatrical concept or even a storyline. Our last album actually was a concept album. And you'll see all sorts of traditional sideshow tricks and pyrotechnics like things that we're known for. We have things like exploding cymbals on the drum set, and we light the mic stands on fire. And some of the performance artists have their own signature tricks, like, you know, they hammer these, you know, 1.5-foot-long nails into their head or whatever. Or my favorite one is they lie on a bed of machetes, and then they put a cinder block on their chest and they smash it with a sledgehammer while they're lying on the machetes. Stuff like that. So
right.
It's pretty grandiose.
sure. And you've really got some colorful sort of face paint or makeup know, going on.
Lots of costumes, yes. Yeah.
That's certainly the first thing that struck me was, yeah, the costumes. Very fun stuff. So the reason we are talking is because Xerxes bought my course, Music Marketing Manifesto, some time ago. And, you know, as I said in some previous interviews, you see different types of people coming through the doors, and some people struggle with the marketing concepts and strategies. Others sort of, do very well. And Xerxes was one of those people who did very well. And in fact, to date, he's reported probably some of the most successful stats that anyone has reported in terms of conversion rates. Before we get into that, why don't we start off by just kind of talking to people about your experience in terms of marketing and sales and success prior to changing up some of your strategies, embracing some of these direct response marketing strategies that perhaps you learned in the course. So let's start at the beginning in terms of what you were doing and what kind of results you were having, maybe some of the frustrations or successes that you were having in your career prior to embracing direct response marketing.
Sure. The biggest thing that, obviously the thing that lacked the most was album sales online, and maybe perhaps album sales in stores too. Most bands will tell you, and I even saw this in, I think it was your survey a year ago, where do you sell most of your albums? At the concert. Right? 90% of album sales for independent bands happen at the concert. And the problem is you can't be playing every night all the time. There's a cost in that. It costs money to play. And it would I just thought, when are we going to be able to sell albums without having to be there in person to sell them? You know, how come every year we only see, you know, a fistful of CDs sold off of our website, or our distributor cuts us a check for selling four albums last fall or whatever, and that's that, you know, because we started to buy and invest in advertising. We had a publicist we've worked on and off with for 2 years, and worked with online ads and things, you know, spent money on our website and whatnot. And we had several different versions of our web store, and nothing really made any difference. The same half dozen, you know, digital sales would happen every now and then, and that was it. And it's not, you know, it's nothing really. And I think a lot of bands will identify with that. I know some bands that have told me they've never sold anything online, you know, and I can believe it. I see how slow it is. So, I saw that Music Marketing Manifesto, blueprint video, and I watched it and I got it. I understood exactly what we were missing. And to be quite honest, we were very close to doing that already, using direct response marketing, we weren't doing it right. So I realized in the end, we were just going to invest in getting all the tools, that came with the music marketing package. And we did. And I think throughout December, I set it up, and January 10th, everything went live, our whole system, our email autoresponder system for our fans. We had a mailing list before, but it wasn't very, interactive. It didn't really do much. And then literally about, I think, 10 days after everything started, we started selling albums, and people were just, you know, I just opened my email one day and I saw two or three PayPal notices saying people had bought our stuff online. And by the end of February, we had already sold more than we had from our old web store in all of the previous year.
Wow.
And that was just from doing some very poor dunderheaded advertising. We weren't very good at it yet. That came a little later. The fact of the matter is that we were able to, we have sold, actually to this date now, we've outsold almost 2 years of our previous web store's web sales.
In how long a period of time?
Just under 3 months.
Wow, that's incredible. So just to kind of color this in for anyone who's maybe stumbled upon the podcast from iTunes and isn't really familiar with what we do here, you know, what I teach is basically, in a nutshell, a form of marketing that's traditionally known as direct response marketing, and it involves essentially, instead of doing what musicians are typically doing and going and, you know, creating this great album, hopefully, and then putting it out on iTunes and getting out there and doing shows and maybe getting a little press and hoping that it all somehow comes together and there's this tipping point and people start purchasing music. Instead of doing that, which, as most musicians have experienced, it just really doesn't work for the most part, we go out and we actually consciously drive traffic to an opt-in form of some sort where we exchange some music for someone joining our list. Once they are on our list, we build a relationship and get them more familiar with our music, us as people, and then once that desire is up, then we ask for the sale, and you really ask for it. You really use some basics, some tried and true sales triggers to get people off the fence and to hopefully get them to make the decision to purchase your stuff. And what we see when we do that are not only sales, but some predictable numbers, and that allows us to build an ROI, return on investment based marketing system, where we know how much we are paying to acquire a subscriber, we know how much we are making on our average customer, and we then know how much we can afford to drive traffic. And as long as we make the numbers line up, and it sometimes takes some tweaking, we got a real business model on our hands. So that's what we're teaching, or, you know, what I'm teaching in the course, and that's what Xerxes and his band has embraced so well. So let's kind of well, let's actually just talk some numbers. What are you seeing in terms of conversion rates? What are you seeing when people first land on your Optinform, your squeeze page, as we call it in marketing circles, and what are you seeing in terms of sales?
Well, it took us a while to get the big problem that we ran into was finding our audience and finding people that were potential fans. It was very difficult. It took us a lot of trial and error and tweaking and experimenting with ads. It took us a while. But once we were able to find that audience after that first month or so of trying at different ads, we finally saw over like between 20 to 30% who people 20 to 30% of people that landed on our page actually signed up. That's one particular group. We've had ads aimed at different groups that were as low as 10%, which was pretty typical for most of our traffic. But the most aggressive group, our biggest fans, come from that close to 30%.
Sure, and let's talk about those numbers before we move on to sales. I think what you're talking about there is pretty typical. When you first throw something up and when you first start driving traffic, it usually won't start converting right away. And a lot of people, I've seen this, you know, they'll go out and they'll spend $5 on the ads. They'll just kind of send it to people who like rock and roll music or something fairly general, and they won't see any conversions, or they'll see low numbers. And it really can take some serious dialing in. Of course, we all make different types of music. Some of our music is going to be more accessible to the masses, so sometimes pretty broad targeting works. But you really find, and I'm sure you can attest to this, you really have to zero in on exactly the right potential fan, exactly the right demographic, the right age, sometimes the right location, even sometimes the right sex, and more importantly and most significantly, the right targeting option, the right interest. If you're getting into Facebook advertising, if it was Google, it would be the right keyword. But with Facebook, we target based on interest, things that person has indicated that they like or are engaged with in some capacity, and you really have to dial that in. And I've seen, and I'd be curious to hear your experiences, but I've seen, you know, the same exact squeeze page convert at 2% if the targeting is wrong, and that same ad, that same squeeze page suddenly convert at 30% if I just change that interest. And little things like changing the age range that I'm going after can significantly boost the conversion rate. So there's a lot of variables, and it does take some work to dial that in. And, you know, what I usually tell people is, like, is that at least with cold traffic coming from Facebook, they want to see at least a 20% conversion rate. You're usually going to need to see something along those lines to make things work. It depends how affordable your traffic is. That's going to vary a lot depending on how your ads are doing and the specifics of your campaign. Facebook ultimately will give your campaigns and your ads a certain a sort of quality score, and so one person might be paying 10 cents while another is paying 50, so there's some dialing in to do there. But 30%, especially with paid traffic, that's pretty darn good, and that's about I don't want to say it's a ceiling because I've seen better, but, you know, that's pretty darn good. And if you're converting approximately a third of the people to land on your page, or even a quarter, then that's pretty significant. And I bring it up because I am so exhausted by musicians leaving comments when I'll talk about this stuff, saying, no one's going to give me their email address for free, for music. No one's interested at all. They'll just go pirate it, or, you know, no one's interested in getting music this way. And it's just simply not true. It's true if you're going and putting up some bland offer and talking to the wrong people, but if you know the interests and passions and the dialogue already taking place in your target fan's mind, and then you craft an offer, essentially, you know, some website copy or video or whatever it is you want to put together to speak to those people, if you speak directly to those people and those pre-existing passions and interests, you're going to see conversions, because people, they do want more music, and more importantly, they want the experience that comes along with that music, the potential lifestyle that they get to live vicariously through the voice of an artist, or the brand, you know, that they are ultimately ascribing to, or more importantly, the tribe that they are becoming a part of by aligning themselves with a particular artist. People want that experience, and so if you dial in your message and speak to those people, you will see conversions. What was your experience along those lines?
Well, our experience was very, very different from a lot of examples that I heard about, with case studies that I had heard. The one that comes to mind was the fellow that was marketing his music simply to people that were a fan of of another artist that was very similar to himself. Mm-hmm. And, there is a lot of skepticism in niche market circles, I believe, in music. For example, when I say niche, like extreme niches, like really heavy, death metal bands or really extremely unmarketable, very non-mainstream stuff, there is an attitude that, you cannot market that way to those people. And the interesting thing is it's kind of true. You can't. And the reason is, and this is what made all the difference for us, this is what changed everything, when we realized that our audience was a subculture, right? They are not members of the normality of the world outside, right? You can't say if you like Justin Bieber, you'll like this or something very, very
right.
Mainstream. I'm just using that. It's mainstream.
Sure, sure.
Or even, let's say, Metallica. Metallica is a very mainstream, well-known, they're heavy metal band, but they're very, very, they're very household, right? So we cannot compare ourselves to something else. And the reason is that the niche audience, the subculture, it's a lifestyle. And they will be offended if you tell them what they like. For example, since you like band A, you will like band B. It provokes this attitude that don't tell me what I will and won't like. You don't know me. I'm not part of the mainstream. And
right.
Once we figured that out, we stopped comparing ourselves to other artists, which was really kind of going nowhere with us anyways, because it's like we'd compare ourselves to someone that was remotely mainstream and people would just get freaked out when they saw us. But the bottom line is what we started doing was telling people, look, if you are basically our most successful ad campaigns have been, are you bored with all the music out there? Are you bored with this? Are you looking for something different? Or, and we'd have some provocative pictures of, like, we take our image very seriously in terms of our advertising and our press photos and stuff. So it's grabbing. And we found that worked far better than trying to describe what we play or what we sound like. We don't really do that. We mention, we're a band that we're aggressive. We have an electric cello in the band. We have a theremin player. It's very colorful. But I don't use any genre descriptors. And because there's an instant kind of backlash of also people that are protective of their own little subculture of whatever it may be. Like, you guys aren't death metal, or you're not gothic rock, or you're not whatever, or you don't sound
right.
Like this, or you don't sound like that. And I noticed this long before we even really did direct response marketing, when I bought a $5 ad through Reverb Nation, and they generated an ad for us that said, if you like Marilyn Manson, you'll like New Jacobin Club. And all these people jumped all over saying, this is crap. This sounds nothing like Marilyn Manson.
Right.
I was kind of like, yeah, I agree. It doesn't. I didn't make that ad, but it was generated for us. And, that turned people off. So,
yeah, I think that's a really astute observation. And I think that is really what you just described is the ideal scenario. And that's when people really start to flourish. The stuff is when they are capable of putting themselves in the shoes of that person that is clicking on that ad. And really, when they can understand what that person is thinking, when they are connected with that person, with the dialogue that is already taking place in that person's mind, then you can craft an offer for that person. And while those kinds of ads that you're talking about, where if you like this artist, you might also like this artist, do in my experience work fairly well in various genres. I don't think that they are the best approach by any means, because I don't think that is the first thing that a music lover is really looking for. They're not sitting there saying, you know, I like Bruce Springsteen, I wish there was somebody else like Bruce Springsteen. That may be true, and that may be enough to get them to click and check you out and ultimately turn them into a fan, but I don't think that is necessarily what's taking place in their mind. They've got a tribe that they see themselves as belonging to, and if you can put a message together that speaks to the core passions of that tribe, that instantly causes them to connect with the concept that by connecting with you as an artist and with you in your music, they are flying the flag of their tribe, so to speak, then I think that you're gonna see a positive response and you're gonna see better conversion numbers, and it sounds like that's what you were able to do. So well done there. And I don't know what you're ultimately comfortable sharing, but do you want to talk at all about what you were paying per click? And what kind of click-through rate you're getting?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, and again, we've been working with this for 3 months, and I think it might be a side effect of having such an extreme niche. Our cost per subscriber, basically the amount of money that at the end of the day it cost us to get each person onto our mailing list, I think is on the high side. But the payoff is quite respectable. Like, we're not paying under $1 per subscriber.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's because of our target audience. I think a different target audience may be cheaper, but they may not convert. They may not buy, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So, I have my sheet here. Basically, we'll spend between $1 and $1.70 per subscriber, and our return from every subscriber in the grand scheme of things now has been $2.95.
Awesome. Well, that and those numbers that you just talked about there, for anyone listening, that's really what it all boils down to there. What is your subscriber value, and what are your subscriber acquisition costs? And as long as your value is higher than those acquisition costs, you're seeing growth. And the other thing to remember, of course, is that once you acquire that subscriber, you're going to be seeing income for potentially years. And there's going to be a lot of sort of trickle-down income that you're not going to be able to easily calculate. You know, that person, especially if you're getting into geo-targeted advertising where you're building lists in areas where you tend to perform, you're going to get some of these people coming out to shows. Some of these people are going to be telling their friends. There's going to be growth all over the place. So, even with those numbers, I think there's some additional benefit to be had there. But that's fantastic, and I'm surprised, actually, at the high acquisition cost. Usually it's quite it's quite difficult to make numbers like that work with music, because the average price point of an album is so low. Uh-huh. When you are, even if you're paying $1, which I usually try to keep the numbers under $1, but even then you'd still need a 10% conversion rate, or in other words, 10% of your list would need to buy that album in order to even just break even if you're selling it for $10. But fortunately, we have some tricks that we do to bump that subscriber value so that we can ultimately make numbers work, which we're going to talk about in a second. So can I ask again, I want to get to those sales, but mm-hmm. just I think there's some valuable stuff here. What kind of targeting were you doing if you were not crafting a message to speak directly to a fan of another artist? What kind of targeting were you doing? So you're saying, hey, are you bored with the music that's already out there?
Well,
but obviously there isn't a group of people that have indicated that they are bored on Facebook. So how are you lining up an audience with that kind of message?
What we did was we actually did take other bands that had elements or similarities with us, but we did not draw attention to the fact that that's what we were doing. So, for example, there is, I'm just using some very obvious points. Like I said, like we have an electric cello in our band, so we target everyone that liked the band Apocalyptica, which is the electric cello band that plays heavy metal, right?
Sure.
And we're a little more rock and rollish punky than we are heavy metal, but we would target that audience, but we would not mention any, we would not provoke them into thinking that we sound like that band. We wouldn't mention the band. We just say, are you a fan of electric cello, or are you bored with all the other bands out there? Are you looking for something new? Are, you know, would you, you know, that sort of, I don't have a list of my ad copy in front of me. Right?
Sure,
but that's what we do. And same thing with some other bands that that maybe even as shallow as it sounds, maybe even dress somewhat what we do. That would, at a glance, maybe people would make a, you know, there all the similarities between the theatrical aspect of the band and these, you know, maybe I would like them. But again, we wouldn't come right out and say, if you like them, you'll like us.
Sure.
Because that got absolutely no reaction. And in some cases, if we were running those actual newsfeed ads, we'd get some nasty comments, but we actually don't run newsfeed ads at all anymore.
Okay, you're just doing right column?
Yeah. Yeah.
And what kind of click-through rate are you getting on those ads?
Click-through, oh boy. I don't have that part. I'm sorry.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Do you know if it's under or over 0.1%?
It's over 0.1. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and again, to anyone who's listening, and well, you're probably aware of this, just a little tip. Basically, if you need to bring those the cost per click down, you really need to get the click-through rate up. It's going to be in direct proportion. The higher that click-through rate, then the less you're going to be spending. So often, if your subscriber costs are high, as you just expressed that they were, by coming up with perhaps a catchier title or a more thought-provoking title, rather, or especially images. Images are probably the most important factor here in terms of click-through rate. Absolutely. Coming up with something that gets a higher click-through rate is going to drop those prices, and of course, it's going to drop those the subscriber acquisition costs considerably. So something to keep in mind. Let's get to the fun part and let's talk about sales. So you're driving traffic via right column ads on Facebook, speaking to the potential boredom with music with a very niche audience.
Actually, sorry to interrupt you. I just remembered you made me remember our headline above our ads was always a quotation from we were always using social proof from a review. And so the ones we used the most were usually two or three words, provocative and controversial, and original and alluring was another one. So we have a lot of social proof to work with, social proof being, you know, album reviews from the past. So we use that quite a bit in our advertising. And I'm sorry I didn't make that clear. It's those quotations that we use as headlines for those ads.
Gotcha. But ultimately, you are speaking to that potential board with the status quo.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you're running ads from Facebook, using the right column ads. You are speaking to, again, that potential boredom out there with music, but you are targeting people who tend to like music similar to what you make. About 20 to 30% of those people, and of course that varies, but 20 to 30% of the people who click on that ad and land on your squeeze page are ultimately signing up to get some free music. From there, a series of emails that you have pre-written and that are programmed to go out at set intervals is taking over and getting people more familiar with the band, the kind of music you make, and really building that bond. You know, you don't walk up to a person and say, hey, buy this. You know, that's not going to go over well, just as you don't walk into a bar and say, hey, want to come home with me, to somebody, you know, that catches your eye. You get to know each other first, and I think that's an important part of marketing, and I cannot tell you how many emails I get because people have just stolen my email and added to their mailing list saying, you know, buy my CD, and that is what their marketing message effectively is. And that really is a terrible idea in this world where we're trying to create a tribe. We need to build that bond and build that interest and build genuine and authentic relationships. Talk about that a little bit, because I know you were initially, I remember a few emails where you're a little uncomfortable about this. How much do I expose myself? We've created an image that we're protective of, and how much do I pull back the curtain? Talk about your feelings there, what you ultimately expressed and what the response was, and how you think that plays into the success.
Yeah, actually, that I think is what played into the success, because, again, most independent bands sell most of their albums at the concert, right? So I was thinking, what happens at a concert? And we sell plenty of albums when we play live after the show. What happens at the concert that doesn't happen online? And it's just that people aren't meeting you. They're not seeing, you know, they want to be around you, talk to you, ask you questions. And the thing with our blog posts, and there are, like, as you mentioned, there's emails that go to the people once they're on the mailing list. These are blog posts. These are entries that only people that are on the mailing list can read. The general public cannot read them. The general public stumbling onto our website or our blog is going to see a certain set of blog posts written by some band members and some people that are just associated with the band. But the blog posts that our mailing list gets, that they have access to, one of them is about how I started this band 17 years ago and how I was basically, you know, like, beaten into the ground in the mid-90s by all the people that say, you can't do this, that's not cool, what you guys are doing is, you know, this is when, you know, bands like Pearl Jam and Nirvana were just huge, 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 and you had to be, you know, keeping it real and wearing, you know, just the jeans and the t-shirt, and everything was, you know, anti-glam and anti-flash and flare and everything. And it was about my experiences starting the band. And I get a lot of feedback from that story. The story is actually about one person that emailed me after my band broke up and said, "When, you know, how do I get your music? When are you playing again? This and that." It was just one guy that emailed me, and I thought someone actually liked my band, and that's how I introduced myself to our mailing list, and then email. Our next blog post that they have access to is a bit of a public scandal that my band was involved with a few years ago that, again, won't talk about publicly just to the average person stumbling upon us. But it's letting people into what's going on behind the scenes with us. So,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's one of the hardest parts to teach of this whole process is in a nutshell, what to blog about. And it's not that, you know, teaching people what to blog about is difficult, but teaching people, you can't really teach someone who they are, and that's ultimately what you need to be blogging about or making videos about or communicating in your emails, whatever it is. It's about connecting, and it's about that kind of natural dialogue that you would have as you made a friendship. It's the same thing that we're doing. We're just doing it virtually, and we're doing it to some extent on a scalable level. It's going to be different for every artist. And I think people just, you know, need to dig deep, and they need to find that thing about themselves that makes them different, that makes them unique, and makes them something that someone can fall in love with. And I think we're still dealing with a clashing of two worlds, this modern technological social media age meeting the old world of elusive, mysterious rock stars who you never hear from and you don't get any real glimpse into. And that used to be part, at least, of what being a rock star was. And in fact, I just had an email exchange with somebody the other day who was concerned about that, you know, that things like crowdsourcing or crowdfunding seem weak, and communicating in the way that I'm suggesting and that a lot of people are doing. He wasn't being particularly critical. He was just expressing his concerns, that rock stars needed to be these sort of mysterious kings and not these people tweeting about what they had for breakfast. And while, you know, I'm not necessarily suggesting we need to be tweeting about what we have for breakfast, I don't agree with that old perception, and I used to. I really did. I was so late on social media because I felt the same way, and it was a big blow to my ego to have to admit that I was just a regular person. But once I started doing that, I started seeing results and the fan base growing and communication that I never had in the past. And I just think and once you feel that, once you feel that connection because you've opened up, I think it's so inspiring and it's so great. And you realize, wait, I can put down my guard and drop all this facade and BS and be real with people, and I'll actually get rewarded for that. You know, it boosts your confidence. It makes you less cautious, and it helps you become stronger or at least more confident in your own sense of identity and, again, brand, and it makes you a better artist, better person, you know, certainly a better marketer. And I think it's interesting to note that, you know, what you were communicating, it was the ugly side of the picture to some extent. You know, you weren't going, hey, my band just produced with Grammy winning producer, or my band just recorded something with Grammy winning producer so and so. It wasn't the usual garbage. It was, you know, hey, I used to get a whole lot of crap for doing what I'm doing, and it's because of people like this guy who sent in an email, and you, the reader, that I'm still making music. You've changed my life. You know, I'm sort of very much paraphrasing, but it's that opening up to people and showing your vulnerable side, your real side, that I think ultimately really helped connect. And again, it's counterintuitive for some. So well done there. And so again, so now they've gone through your autoresponder series, these emails that are programmed to go out. You've got them familiar with who you are. You've built that bond, and then you go in for the sale and you really ask for it. That's something you hear a lot about in marketing circles. You need to ask for the sale, because if we just sort of casually say, hey, my stuff's on iTunes, check it out, people, one, are probably not going to check it out. Two, if they do, they'll check it out and they'll decide that they'll come back later, because no one's in a rush to part with money. And if they have that opportunity to just come back and check it out, they will. Well, at least they'll put it off, and usually that will result in the loss of a sale. But if we really go out and find a creative and friendly way of saying, hey, would you buy this right now? I'll make it worth your while in this way, shape, or form, then we're going to see much higher sales rates. And again, we're going to start edging towards that predictable conversion rate that we need in order to make a system like this work. So talk about that. What kind of conversion rates were you seeing in terms of sales?
Well, that's where everything changes for us. We see really high. We've seen basically around 20% of everyone that initially signs up to our list buys our album. And then of that 20%, a few of those people go on to actually, either through our suggestion or just all on their own, they go out and buy most of our back catalog. I've seen people that you know, buy the album that we're offering at a sale price, and then go to our other web store and just buy everything. And that's and that has been very surprising, because I always thought, well, where were these people before? You know, well, quite simply, they didn't know we existed, right?
Right, right.
And we had introduced ourselves to them, and they didn't feel like they had seen us or known us or familiar. You know what I mean? We're just a little icon or a little ad at the corner of a screen they saw. You know, that's not, you know, that's, or even a really expensive print ad. You know, we pay $1,500 for a little print ad in a big magazine. And what do you get from it? Like, can you actually trace how many sales that are generated from that advertisement that you paid for? You can't.
Yeah,
and in some
usually because there aren't any.
Right, exactly. There aren't any. I believe that. I strongly believe that. So yeah, so at the end of the day, we were seeing between 18 and 21% of everyone that of people that were on our list were purchasing.
Yeah, and that's that's tremendous for the record. You know, there might be some who are just stumbling upon this who aren't familiar with what's normal. Most markets, you know, and I'm talking non-music markets, the big giant companies out there are hoping to see a 1 or 2% conversion rate. I'm seeing people that at least get this dialed in, they're seeing on average probably 4 to 6%, which is considered very good. 4 to 6% of your list are ultimately buying. I've seen, I think, I want to say prior to you, maybe 10% or somewhere in that neighborhood being about as high as I've seen. And here you're seeing, you know, an 18 to 21% conversion rate. You know, 20% of your list buying your stuff is tremendous. And they're not just buying your album. As you say, they're buying additional products, your back catalog. Let's talk about that. So you drive people eventually in this series, they're getting sent a direct email, really just saying, hey, would you buy my stuff in not so many words?
Yeah.
And then one in five are, which again, it's just huge. And then once that order is completed, what's happening?
Well, you said the word, you mentioned iTunes and the words. The wording is important. We are actually trying to get our fans on our side in terms of like fighting with the industry. We tell them, don't buy our album from iTunes. Don't buy our album from Amazon. We have albums that you can buy in regular, you know, channels. Buy it from us and it'll be cheaper and we'll give you these extra songs. Like basically that's what it is, right? We're actually trying to we're trying to get everyone on a side of, you know, yeah, you know, like let's buy straight from the band. Let's not buy from iTunes, even though we do make some of that money from the iTunes sales and Amazon. But and that's actually, I think, in a way, that's what wins people over, you know. And then what happens is they buy our album and they get a free EP with it, and it's cheaper than on iTunes. They get, as kind of a thank you for, you know, buying our album, you know, thank you for shelling out money and spending it on a band that, you know, you didn't know about a month ago, that independent band. Hey, we've been around for 15 years. We have 4 albums and about 4 EPs and a DVD, and we put this big package together, and you can have it for this, like, I know, John, what you told me was too cheap, and they have that option. They have that option of instantly becoming a completist. They instantly will have everything we've ever done. And I think a lot of people in extreme niche markets are completists. And when you have a fan that's a completist, you have a fan that's going to buy everything else you ever put out. So we really want our fans to have a complete collection. And that's something that we feel strongly about. And some of our material is hard to find, as some of it was not released outside of Canada for licensing reasons, and we even come clean and tell them that you can't get this anywhere else. We don't know why. It's some music industry baloney about this and that and the other thing, and you know, so here all of it right here now. You can have it if you want.
Right. And just to clarify, that's right there on the thank you page. Essentially, they order, they get taken to a page, they get redirected to a page after ordering, and they see this offer that you put together with pictures of all the albums. It's this big giant mountain of stuff that they can get for this low price that you sell for how much?
It's 2 CDs, a DVD, and 7 digital releases for $29.
Gotcha. Wow. Yeah. I do think that's too cheap. But and what percentage of your audience is ultimately picking that up? Like of the buyers? I know you've gone through a few hiccups there in terms of dialing in that offer. But you know you made X amount of sales. What percentage of them so far have purchased the second tier?
The funny thing about that is I don't have that number, because we have some people that bought it, that bought that box set outside of the email chain.
Sure.
Because actually, we normally sell that box set for more than that. But our logic is, if they just spent $10 on a digital album that is already included in that box set with another bonus release that's included in that box set, that's why we're giving them the break, that one-time break. If you want to get the rest of everything right now, we're going to give it to you for this too cheap price, because we understand you just spent money to if they purchased that box set without buying the digital, without buying one of the releases first, is is noticeably more money than that. It's just that we really want people to not feel like they just got like sold the same thing twice, right? Because in fact, they are getting they are getting an album and an EP that they just bought in that box set, and we don't want them to feel like we're trying to sell it to them twice and make it a faster buck.
Sure,
so
that,
you know, we're
that,
very
that
very conscientious of that. Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, you know, in terms of industry averages, what I'll usually see on an upsell, and it can vary, it can go lower, it can go even higher, but I'd like to see usually between 10 and 30% on an upsell. Right now I'm seeing about 30% on some of my stuff. Sometimes it's lower. It really kind of depends how you dial that in and how appealing you ultimately make it. And I think it's important to understand the psychology that led to the purchase in the first place. You know, in other words, why did they buy? What value are they perceiving? And then going and giving them even more value for an even better deal on that page. If you do that right, you'll see the conversion rates you're ultimately after. And as we were discussing before we were recording, another thing you can do is then follow up with those people that maybe didn't buy because they weren't yet acquainted enough with your music, but maybe after they spent a week with your music, they really did fall in love, and at that point they might be interested. So you can follow up with those people and really try and make that sale at another point as well, as it sounds like you're doing. But what is fairly normal if your pricing is right is to make as much money from that second tier sale as you are on the initial sale. I'll usually end up seeing an equation that looks something like that, where if you're making $100 off of 100 subscribers on the initial sale, you're making another $100 or so off of that second tier sale. So a lot of people are really missing out if they're not doing this. And often, in fact, it's hard to make the numbers work if you're just selling a $10 album. But very often the profit will come from that second tier sale. And then, of course, you've got other ways of monetizing the list through live shows, potentially house concerts, merch, future albums, and all of these kinds of things. The nice thing about this process is that, of course, it's snowballing. You know, once you own that list, once you've got 10,000 people on that list or whatever that number is for you, then you've got a real asset that is going to fuel your career for many, many years to come. That's the biggest professional pain in my life, is all my time on major labels, all that money, literally millions of dollars spent on my behalf in terms of getting my stuff out there and making albums and whatnot. And I had no mailing list to speak of because, you know, this is really before this kind of thing was very common, if it's not even really common now. But, you know, if you wanted to get on my mailing list, you had to, like, shoot me an email. You had to find some small link somewhere on the site, click on it, click on another link, and then shoot me an email. And I just really had no mailing list to speak of. And I kick myself now thinking, if only I had, you know, put that offer out there when all those eyeballs were really on my career because of, you know, MTV and what the major labels were doing at the time. But such is life, and you know, we figure things out when we do, and we correct, and certainly things are better than ever in that respect now. So one of the things, you know, I think you touched on earlier in this conversation, and I think is worth pointing out again, you hear this a lot in marketing circles and entrepreneurial discussions. You don't want to get yourself in a situation in life where you're trading time for money. It's hard to achieve the financial goals that we're ultimately after, and it's hard to achieve any kind of sustainable success if that's what we're doing. And you described how most musicians are selling albums via shows, and that's absolutely true. That was my experience. That's pretty much everyone's experience before they engage in any kind of real marketing. And one of the reasons I think that's so successful is because of, you know, that, albeit somewhat of a short-lived one, but that bond that you're creating there in the room, whether they're seeing you up on stage, maybe they're a little tipsy and they're really feeling it, they're inspired and excited by what you're seeing. But more importantly, it's usually the conversations that you're having with people after the show, at least when you're an indie artist. I know that I used to hate standing at the merch table. I was shy, and I just hated doing that. But when I just would go and cut a deal with the headliner and say, hey, sell my stuff, I'll give you 10%, I'd sell one or two CDs. When I go and stand there at the merch table, I'd sell 20 or 30 CDs, and the difference was huge, and it was because of those little conversations. People want to connect. We just need to give them a reason to do so. And what we're doing with this process and what Xerxes just described is effectively taking that ideal moment where you're standing at a merch table and you're having a conversation with a fan and you're turning that mild interest into a purchase, we're taking that and we're scaling it up so beyond what we could ever accomplish by performing, and thus avoiding that trap that many successful musicians fall into, where they are married to the road for the rest of their lives if they want to keep paying the bills. And so once again, you know, in that scenario, if you're a touring artist and that's how you make your money, you're trading time for money. But when you stop putting in the time, there's no growth in your career. And with this model, I think that that changes. And that's why I personally gravitated towards it and really started doing this in the first place and now teach it to others. I mean, is that... You know, what's your perspective on that statement?
Actually, going back to exactly that, bands sell most of their albums at concerts, and why is that? It's because they're there. But in speaking about, well, you know, people buying your album and giving the option to buy something more expensive, you know what? That happens at concerts too. How many times have you, or anyone that's listening to this in a band, have you stood after the show and someone pulled out $20 and said, I want that shirt, $10, and you know, give me the 20, I'll give you the CD as well. We do that in person all the time. It's not unique to this direct response marketing. In fact, the idea of giving someone a bigger item to buy, or offering them this upsell or whatever, that comes from what happens in person all the time at the merch table after shows. I don't know how many times I've done it. Someone says, I want this CD and that CD. And we had three albums out, and I said, well, look, just give me the $35 and you can have all three of them and I'll give you this poster or whatever. We do that on the spot. We just, you know, we do that. And also we do it because we see the people are excited and they saw it for the first time and they want all your stuff and they're happy to be talking to you. And you have to transfer that that sort of communication and that sort of exchange. You need to put that online. You need to put that on, make that happen online as well as just at the concert. And that's why and when you will sell things out of your web store and not just at concerts, right? So that's why we do what we do in terms of how cheap our stuff is and what, you know, we like to put together all this stuff, all these CDs and things, and you know, give it to you for one price or whatever, because we do it at shows, we do it at concerts, we'll do it to our fans online as well.
Absolutely. Well, I really recommend anyone listening to this check out the new Jackman Club. Where can people actually, get some free music while we're talking about such things?
Yeah. Well, we have a special page that where you can enter your email address and we will send you like not one or two, but I think it's three free downloads. It's newjacobinclubmusic.com. Just enter your name and email address. You'll get some downloads right away, and you will also get access to our blog posts that are only for our mailing list fans, the ones that you won't see on our website otherwise. So, yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Well, once again, that's New Jacobin, JACOBIN. clubmusic.com. Definitely check them out. They're doing some really fun stuff. I personally have a keen interest in the theatrical, and I love what you guys are doing. It's cool stuff. And if you're just interested in seeing a successful funnel, really experiencing what somebody is experiencing the funnel of somebody who's doing it right, then I suggest you check it out and do them a solid and pick up some of their music while you're there. So any parting words before we kind of move on? I really appreciate you sharing your story and telling folks what's worked for you and what you've been doing. I think this will help color it in for a lot of people who kind of understand the concepts but are perhaps a little unclear on each of the steps and, you know, some of the different factors that can really skew results in either direction. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. Anything else you want to add or any parting words of advice to people?
Yeah, one of the reasons I really was happy to do this podcast with you was because I wanted to be here to actually say to all the extreme kind of niche market bands out there, especially the heavy metal bands and all you bands that think that you are too different or too extreme to participate in this sort of marketing strategy, you're wrong. You can do it. You obviously can't do it exactly the same way as everyone else. And financially, it doesn't work quite the same way, but it does work. You just have to you have to do the work, because it doesn't happen with no work at all. And that's the biggest problem with a lot of those bands, is that they think that just by sitting back and being cool and being, you know, we're just going to wait for people to come and buy our stuff. If they don't, then whatever. They don't like it. That's too bad. Well, you got to go out and find the people that are gonna that want your music, because they are out there. You have to put in the work.
Great points, and you know, it's funny. I hear that a lot. Well, I make this kind of music. I don't know if this is gonna work. It's not mainstream stuff.
Yeah.
And funny enough, the people that I talk to that tend to be the most successful with it are the least mainstream, because when you are in a niche, or even it doesn't have to be a niche. It can just be a very well defined genre like jazz or classical. But when you're making music like that, you know who your audience is. When you're a singer songwriter or a sort of mainstream top 40 artist, that's a huge pool of people, and you got to work a lot harder to really drill down. You could still do it, of course, and you benefit from the fact that you've got a larger audience to work with, but pinpointing your message takes a lot more work. And so I think, yeah, the more you can drill down, the more unique, the more specific you're doing, the better your chances. So great point. Once again, check them out. newjacobinclubmusic.com. Again, that's JACOBIN clubmusic.com. Check them out. Xerxes Horde, thanks again for being on this call, and thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Take care.
All right. Once again, John Ojaka here, and a big thank you to Xerxes Horde for coming on the show and sharing all of that hard-won information. Really valuable stuff. Some really good insight there. And once again, it just, you know, it really proves that fact that people are in fact buying music, which, try as I might, is hard to convince the average struggling independent artist of. You know, people they want to really hold on to this misery. Because I think the average musician is taking a lot of kicks, you know, and they've had a hard time selling product, and it's easier for many to believe that it can't be done than to believe that there is hard work out there to be done. So again, Xerxes, another success story and more proof that people are buying music. You just need to know how to reach those fans. So once more, thanks again to Xerxes Horde for sharing all of that with us. And thanks to you guys for listening. I really appreciate it. If you'd like to learn more about the strategies that we discussed, as always, head on over to musicmarketingmanifesto.com. You can either sign up for a free copy of the Music Marketing Blueprint, or you can check out Music Marketing Manifesto 3.0, the course that we discussed in this podcast episode. All right, once more, thanks for listening, and I don't know, rock on. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Music Marketing Manifesto podcast with John Ojaka. If you'd like to learn more music marketing strategies, then go to musicmarketingmanifesto.com. That's musicmarketingmanifesto.com. And sign up for your free copy of the Music Marketing Blueprint.